Why don't we start?
Hello. We're still missing a few barreling as and when. As my train inched reluctantly towards London Bridge this morning, it didn't want to get there any more than anyone else on it did, apparently, there was a fun kind of bleak housey kind of vision of the whole of the city of London. We inched past Canary Wharf on our way to London Bridge, a bit murky, and the Gherkin, the NatWest Tower, all those things were just shrouded in fog as it started to rain, even though Radio 4 had said, clear skies, pouring, everywhere north of Croydon. That's Croydon for you. This fantastic fog, I thought, across the city of London, very like how Charles Dickens starts Bleak House when he talks about the legal system. The Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall at the heart of a great fog. And this metaphor for how the legal system works, no one understands it, the lawyers least of all, apparently. And it struck me as a fun metaphor for what we're starting to talk about now in relation to conduct of business regulation. Because for many people dealing with financial institutions, what financial products involve, even sort of basic pension funds involve, are a mystery. Yeah, there's maths involved there. All sorts of complicated words, all kind of fun words like guarantee start appearing, and everyone just relies on the fact it says guaranteed something. Barclays got adverts at the minute saying guaranteed return. What's emerged out of the credit crunch is lots of firms that were selling products with guaranteed returns, Morning Microsoft, is that actually those guarantees were only effectively contractual type promises that ultimately were products which Lehman Brothers had sourced and had sold out around the world through a series of independent financial advisors in various institutions. So the guarantee ultimately was a guarantee, meaning everyone expects Lehman Brothers will always be able to pay this stuff. So as lawyers, I mean, we have to start thinking about some of these adverts, and we mentioned financial promotions yesterday, you know, in what sense guarantee? My mum was looking at things recently and saying, oh, I invest in this bond, dear, you know. These silver saver things, they're always going for, you know, basically our parents, grandparents, those kind of generations, because they've got money, you know, and haven't been spending it on shoes or in Topshop like, you know, normal people. And so, you know, they're the ones you want to target as investors. So they're offering them slightly preferential rates with the word guarantee written all the way across it. So they go, don't buy any of this stuff. Well, do you know what the guarantee is? No, but it says guaranteed. It doesn't mean anything. It's fog. Behind that guarantee, the people that were buying things sourced by Lehman Brothers had no idea Lehman Brothers was involved. They thought it was being guaranteed by the nice man or woman that was selling it to them face to face. Even when we get to slightly more sophisticated financial institutions, we're going to talk a little bit today about a case called Bankers Trust and Damala, where an Indonesian financial institution was dealing in interest rate swaps and then latterly claimed had no idea what they were, how they functioned, or what the risks were that were involved in them. What conduct of business regulation is supposed to be about is shining a light through the fog. Is that the best metaphor? If you shine a light on fog, often you just get a reflection of fog back, don't you? We're going to somehow get through the fog to make it more... Thank you. There's one person having trouble with my metaphor. We're going to have to try and clear this fog away. We're going to have to try and explain to people what they need to know. Now, of course, this is problematic at one level. We don't want to waste a lot of time, if we're Goldman Sachs, explaining the risks of a product to Morgan Stanley, if Morgan Stanley know all about it as well, because they're also a big financial institution. No need to baby other market counterparties. And maybe it's what are often referred to in the financial press as widows and orphans. American bankers particularly love jargon, and this is the one. The people we ought to be most worried about are the widows and orphans. These, of course, you know, if they're children, these orphans, they won't be able to affect contracts, but you know what I mean. These people who are going to be investing their tiny little all, yes, their life savings, those are the people we want to look after. And so what conduct of business regulation is doing is saying we've got to explain the risks, we've got to part the fog in a way that's suitable, that's appropriate for different types of customer. And one thing I think that's a particularly interesting theme about conduct of business regulation when compared to contracts, and we mentioned this yesterday, is that in contract law ordinarily, we have a principle of freedom of contract, meaning the parties are free to agree whatever they like, and they're only going to be held in contract law to things they've actually agreed. So if it's not in the contract, you don't have to do it. In contract law, as you know also, we can exclude liabilities. An idea we'll come back to a bit later on. But we won't be liable for X, Y, and Z. Conduct of business regulation, however, imposes positive obligations outside and beyond what the parties may want to put in their contract. So in that sense, conduct of business regulation is a great leveller. Introduces a greater level of fairness for people that maybe don't know, don't understand, need to have risks explained to them. Okay, so that's the background of what we're doing. And I like Dickens's fog metaphor anyway, so I make no excuses for using it all the time. Okay. So you might be thinking, you know, is this such a huge problem? Do we need to worry about all this stuff? Is it all as awful as you say? Are you standing there whinging lefty, you know, moaning about these things? This is from Wednesday, October the 14th, Financial Times. So I'm being held hostage, I need to show the day's newspaper. One in five hedge fund managers found to be misrepresenting facts. Funny. Let's zoom in a little bit. How exciting. One in five hedge fund managers misrepresents their fund or its performance to investors during formal due diligence investigations. This isn't even what you tell them over the phone when you're selling them stuff. Formal due diligence investigations, when lawyers are there, you're misrepresenting what you do and how your products work. According to a lot of research at New York University Stern School of Business, an august body if ever there was one. The research is likely to be a further blow to the reputation of a battered industry, meaning hedge funds in particular, which has faced increasing demands for transparency from investors in the wake of the credit crisis. Crunch, crisis, who knows what we call it. Using confidential data taken from 444 due diligence reports commissioned by investors between 2003 and 2008, academics at Stern analysed the extent to which hedge fund managers' representations about their funds differed from reality. Managers most commonly misrepresented the amount of money they had entrusted to their funds, their performance, and their regulatory and legal histories, according to the research. Lies, 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 lies. This is 20% of what they're doing. This is why we need conduct of business regulation, because even in formal due diligence proceedings where there will be lawyers are hunting, we're still not telling the whole truth, let alone what we're saying to people when we're trying to sell them our stuff. This is what conduct of business regulation is all about. One of the most maudlin sights, actually, in the credit crunch, one we'll come back to later on, was watching Alan Greenspan, formerly head of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, which is as close as the USA gets to having a central bank. And he was the presiding genius over the boom, really, through the 90s. It was thought his steady hand on the tiller with monetary policy and so on and so forth was what was really guiding the USA through all of that. And he said in his memoirs, it's not a bubble that's growing, it's just froth. There are lots of small little bubbles, it'll all be fine. There are just little peaks in the market, you know, they'll all level out in time. And then, of course, the credit crunch turned out to be an enormous bubble and burst horribly. And giving evidence to Senate committees in October 2008... I'm sure you'll be able to find all this on YouTube. He said, it never occurred to me that markets wouldn't act rationally ultimately so as to keep the market going. It never occurred to me they'd behave like this. Alan Greenspan is one of the preeminent free marketeers in that sense. You know, he was the steady hand on the tiller for a very, very long period of time. Clinton trusted him implicitly, you know, Bush latterly, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the whole banking sector thought, brilliant, we've got Greenspan, it'll all be all right. And so even he, well, I think it was really quite a maudlin sight watching him saying, I can't believe these people won't act rationally. So we find these kind of things. I think you can think of the FT as being our kind of newspaper record in this jurisdiction for this stuff. Really think of the FT as being a gossip sheet. This is what people have been doing in the city. Yeah, who's up and who's down and all that kind of stuff. It's like pop charts, but with more money involved. So I think we have to think conduct of business regulation has a role to play. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to deal with these kind of contexts, you know, making sure these people behave properly. What we don't have is case law to tell us how these rules work in detail. So the fun for us is in looking at factual scenarios and thinking, well, how do we think those regulations should play out? And one of the things that we're going to tie up in future sessions, which will then appear in assessments and examinations, all those kind of fun things I would expect, will be problem questions on how would contract law deal with this, you know, how will conduct of business regulation change how ordinary contract law should work. Because if contract law will say you can exclude your liability except unfair contract terms and all that stuff, conduct of business regulation is putting these positive obligations up front first. These are things you have to do in dealing with your customer. And so the question for us is, to what extent is contract law likely to change in the financial context? So we have, you know, a new area of law here, in effect, contract law as it applies to financial transactions. Okay. So our source of law for all of this, after all that preamble, page 29 in your handout. MiFID, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive. Now, this is the EC directive, implemented on the 1st of November 2007. They're still comparatively recent. It's one of those days I'm going to have to try and talk through the coughs. That was sarcastic, that last one. As I said with MiFID, MiFID is the one that worried financial institutions because it took to these high-level principles and instead of telling them exactly what they must do, it created a lot of framework principles about how they're supposed to behave and basically put the onus on the institutions themselves to decide how do we create systems and procedures to do that. Quite scary for an institution. They're used to being told this is what you must do, and they knew they'd done it when they ticked the box. We've done that one, 14 things we've got to do, done the first one, done the second one. Now they've got to figure out for themselves, how do they comply with a load of different regulatory standards. The purpose of MiFID under 2.1, we've got the Markets and Financial Instruments Directive, MiFID itself. Yes, thank you. 2004, Directive 39 EC. There's an implementing directive which adds some extra provisions. You don't need to know about that in detail, but that was 2006. And a technical regulation which gives us all the meat and detail from 2006 as well, the Commission's technical regulations. That's where you'd find that. And then we have the FISMA Markets and Financial Instruments Regulations of 2007. We're just going to focus on the high-level principles in MiFID itself. Okay, that's what's important for this course. But otherwise, if you want to look and see how implementing legislation is done, you've got all the sources for the other stuff there as well. There were three things really going on in MiFID. The authorisation of firms to conduct investment business was the first thing, which we brushed past very briefly when we looked at authorisation last week. That will come back to that in later sessions. Secondly, the regulation of the markets on which investments are bought and sold. And I talked about how we were trying to level the playing field between exchanges, multilateral trading platforms, and systematic internalisers. You might remember that weird expression. That's another thing MiFID was doing, changing how the market functions. So it didn't matter through which portal you were buying your investments, basically. And for our purposes, most importantly, for our purposes today, the regulation of the conduct of business. So high-level principles about how that is supposed to function. So we're moving towards principles-based regulation. Also in MiFID, we're passporting regulatory approvals, as we've discussed under Lamfalussy. If you get an authorisation in one member state, effectively you get a passport, so that authorisation works in all member states in the EU. Okay? Remember, this is how we're trying to do harmonisation these days. And so what are these key principles? Now, I've done a couple of podcasts for you overnight, they'll go up on the site, which try to, again, summarise and lead you through some of these. What I suggest you think of it as is some kind of pyramid, but the wrong way up, or the wrong way down, depending on how your brain works. You've got this idea that you've got to act with integrity. Yes, investment firms must act with integrity in the Principles for Businesses source book. We talked about that last week. So that, I think, is the overarching background principle. Yeah? In MiFID particularly, then, we have teasing out some important principles. Best execution is one that really bothered everybody in the marketplace. This is in Article 21 of MiFID. Investment firms must take all reasonable steps. Who knows what reasonable steps means? If you remember Barclays Bank and O'Brien, which we'll talk about later, of course, that was a case that required reasonable steps to be taken in contract law. So one thing we might do here is to say, well, trying to work out what reasonable steps means, maybe we'll borrow in this jurisdiction from that Barclays Bank and O'Brien jurisprudence, which we'll talk about when we do contract law, I promise again. So there we are.
fund that that's reasonable steps. I haven't checked, and you might want to check this directive in other languages, and see, you know, what, how do they translate reasonable steps? I've never managed to find it. How do the French do that? How do the Germans do that? That would be fun. Take reasonable steps to obtain, when executing orders, the best possible result for their clients. An obligation to get the best possible result for their clients, taking into account price, cost, speed, likelihood of execution and settlement, size, nature, or any other consideration relevant to the execution of the order. So when you're fulfilling an order for a client, acquiring securities for them, acquiring whatever it is the client wants, you have to take reasonable steps to obtain the best possible result. Who knows what that's going to take to? That can be taken any number of different ways. Does that mean the highest available profit? It feels like at first blush. Or does it mean more generally, if your client's objective is to buy a security to offset another loss somewhere else, that the best possible result is the offsetting of that loss? I mean, who knows? Is it contextual in that way? But it does read as though you're getting the best possible profit out of that. It's certainly been taken in the marketplace to mean you've got to get the best available price. So you can't just, as I think a lot of firms used to do once upon a time, just say, well, you want some shares, do you? You want some shares in the technology sector? We've got a load of rubbish out the back. We'll sell you some of that. Yeah? It's not like buying fruit on Holborn. You know, one of those markets, you know, appear where there must have been a building once upon a time, flogging, you know, you just want one of the oranges off the front and they give you that kind of fruit soup they've got out the back ladled to you in a round paper bag. Now this is, you've got to produce the best available price. Now that's concerning for institutions. You know, what is a reasonable step there? They've got to try and design a system for getting the best possible result. The best possible result. Who in the world wants the best possible outcome for you other than your mother? I mean, you know. The best possible result. So you've got to say, I can reasonable, you've got to design a system in advance which is going to satisfy their faith that that's what you're doing. This is why the firms are nervous. They're going to do the best possible for their customers. Because otherwise we might think, well, some of these firms would be quite happy then just being what are known as market makers. We've already got this particular type of share. You want something in the technology sector, we'll just sell you what we've got. Is that the best possible result? How do you justify that ex post facto? So that's quite demanding. 2.3, the best interests of the client under Article 19.1 of MiFID. Investment firm must act honestly, fairly and professionally in accordance with the best interests of its client. So first off, starting at the end, you've got to work out what are the client's best interests. Ordinarily, we might just think profit. But if your client's coming to you because they need something in particular, whether it be a steady income, where they have a particular exposure to movements in interest rates and they want you to sell them something that will offset that exposure, what's known as hedging, when you try and use one product to offset the danger you have of losing somewhere else. That's a sophisticated job and quite a time-consuming one, trying to work out what is it the customer's after. Yeah? You can't just pick up the phone and say, have some stuff. You know, you've got to start looking at the client, thinking, what do they want? You've got to act honestly. That sounds sensible. Again, what does honestly mean? We'll talk a lot more later on in the course about dishonest assistance and what honestly and dishonestly means. Be familiar to everyone that's done Property 2 already. We'll also talk about it when we come to look at the criminal law and gosh test and all those kind of fun things. Fairly. Who knows? In jurisprudence, you don't do John Rawls, do you? He had a philosophical theory of fairness. There was a little philosophical debate about what fair means. But legal problems, I mean, it's not a word we come across a lot in legal terms, so who knows what fairly means. Maybe what we do is we go back up or down our pyramid, depending on how you've drawn it, to the idea of integrity. Maybe fairly means a firm's got to act with integrity, and so fairness sort of flows from that. Is it to be read as being akin to honestly? Or is the whole idea that we're trying to be non-legal in this? I mean, we don't even have a jurisprudence to tell us, in interpreting these regulations, are we supposed to be legal in the way that we've tended to be in everything we've studied so far in terms of contract law and tort and looking at the old cases and everything else? Or should we just try and give them literal vernacular meanings? We haven't even got that kind of jurisprudential help in this area. And professionally. This is a word that bothers me enormously, professionally. Michael Lewis's very good book, Liar's Poker, which is just a fun history of someone English going to work in New York for Salomon Brothers, and how we'd like working amongst feral beasts on a trading floor. He talks about his dislike of the word professional, and it's one that always used to bother me as well. Bankers always talk about themselves as being professional. You have to dress professionally, which I took them to mean suit and tie, as opposed to the way in which you put the suit and tie on had to be professional. But they have this idea, you've got to be professional, which means kind of starchy, straight-backed, a bit dull, you know, don't do anything out of place, do what everyone else is doing. Those of us that studied trusts last year, we looked at Nestle and NatWest and trust investment, and the defence there of as long as you were doing what everyone else in the market was doing, you were acting appropriately. There's that kind of sense in banking markets that you've got to act cautiously and nicely and everything else. Trading floors seem to be slightly different. You're allowed to be a feral beast if you make money there. But corporate finance, the big American banks, they're working at Citibank as well. I used to wear striped ties, and the Americans didn't. And I used to get told off, why are you wearing a straight tie, they used to call it. I'm sorry? I stopped making facetious jokes about should I wear a gay one instead, because it just whoom everyone's head. I wasn't behaving like everyone else again, that was a bad thing. But again, why was I wearing a striped tie? No one else wears striped ties, why are you? You're not dressing like everyone else, you're weird, you're different. No, you're scaring us. You're causing alarm, you know. This idea of professional, it's a very odd word. And Michael Lewis spends a lot of time talking about, what does professional mean? There's this obsession with the word professional. If you want to be really painful, banking isn't a profession, which is something we're going to need to think about as we talk about the credit crunch as well. The professions historically were the clergy, you know, you were holy orders and all that kind of stuff, the law and medicine. Those are the good old school professions. Nowadays we've added accountancy and things onto that. My definition of something that's a profession means assimilating a body of knowledge and a body of professional ethics as well. You can't study to be a banker. There just isn't such a thing. It's a job that people do. It may involve lots of skills. It may involve, you know, having degrees in mathematics and everything else. Fine, I'm not saying there isn't skill and intelligence, but not a profession in that sense. The bankers like to, you know, dress as though they are and think about themselves as though they are. So what the word professionally means here, I don't know. It's an odd one. Again, these things aren't defined. It's not like a statute where there's a definitions provision. Fine, what does professionally mean? I think if you talk to bankers, they have a sense of what it means to act professionally. In some places, we'll have dress codes. Oh, heavens, if you go and work in banks, you dress down Friday, woohoo! But what you have to do is you have to have your smart clothes for Monday to Thursday, yeah? And what do you wear when you go in on Saturday and Sunday to work? You then dress down Friday, there is then a code as to what you can and can't wear on dress down Friday. So you end up buying a second wardrobe of things that you can wear on dress down Friday. Yeah? Typically chinos, loafers, you know, those kind of things. Men and women, because it's kind of a unisex, preppy look, which gets you through Friday. You know, because people start going and wearing jeans or shorts or flip-flops, and quickly, that's not professional dress. Just dress down, you know. And there was this for ages. So even the fun bit of dress down Friday, where everyone relaxed, has a separate set of rules. So this idea of what constitutes professionalism in lots of firms just goes on and on and on. Fun. So how we act professionally in the best interests of our clients, you know, we might have a vague idea of what we think that probably means, but I think trying to define it closely would be quite difficult. Communications with clients. Article 19.2. All information addressed to clients or potential clients shall be fair, clear, and not misleading. So again, this idea of fairness. I would suggest in communications, we're thinking about things like advertisements, promotional literature, and so on. I'll come on to that list in a second. But fairness may well involve explaining all the risks necessary for that type of customer. Not making extravagant claims for the product. Is that what we mean by fair? Misleading sounds a bit more like something we would recognise from tort law and Hedley Byrne and Heller, and, you know, not making misstatements, not making ambiguous statements. We're going to spend a lot of time on incorrect and misleading statements when we look at securities regulation later in the course, where there's lots of old case law on that. The basic, summarise all that old case law, really, you can't get away with even ambiguous statements. You have to state everything with, quote, strict and scrupulous accuracy. Look at old cases like Aaron's Reef from the 19th century. So are we supposed to interpret these regulations in accordance with that jurisprudence? Again, we don't have definitions, we have to figure it out for ourselves. Which is fun, because you get to discuss what you think should happen. You get to put that, if you want, into a general economic background. If the FSA is supposed to be acting, looking at the best interest of the UK economy, is it going to be trying to act in a proportionate way? So you don't want to make these rules too stringent. You don't want your idea of fairness to be too harsh. if you think you're trying to encourage people to come to London, you don't want to put people off. That takes you into light touch regulation, that takes you arguably into some of the problems that, you know, led to the credit crunch. So there's a whole range of background factors you can bring in to discuss that there, if, you know, that's an interest for you. Or you can just, you know, jump off the other way into contract law and start borrowing from case law if you'd rather do it on a technical basis. This is all an area, field that we're creating, so we get to do whatever we like. Fun. Honestly. We're allowed to enjoy it. So what are the expected benefits of MiFID? Oh, we've gone from 2.4 to 2.6. Alice, I can't count. There's supposed to be increased competition between market service providers and between different types of markets, particularly in relation to securities and investments. Again, we're still talking about that primarily, as opposed to deposit-taking banking. Again, that's stuff we're going to do at the end of the course, our last full topic. The new conduct of business rules is hoped will enhance investor protection because we've created these positive obligations that we've just been discussing with which our firms must comply. Increased transparency as to the practices of service providers. They've got to be much clearer about what their systems and practices are. Information they also have to provide, as we'll see in a minute, are information about any fees or commissions that they're going to earn themselves. So you can't be selling stuff to your customers and secretly taking a fee or a commission as a result of that. You've got to be upfront about what you as a firm are getting out of it as well. Increased transparency about all the available markets. If you do best execution, you can't just say, well, buy our stuff. You've got to be honest with that customer and say, we're selling it to you at this price. Actually, we could probably get it somewhere else a little bit cheaper. So that's what best execution is supposed to do. It's supposed to introduce proper markets where people aren't just selling you what they've got. So nowadays, you know, with the internet, you can compare prices very easily, can't you? That's effectively what MiFID is trying to introduce. You know, the firm has an onus to ensure that you get the best possible result. And that's a way we might decide to limit that idea. You know, is it just looking at the available prices? More effective and more approximate regulation between member states we've discussed, and principles-based regulation. Okay. 2.7, why are we concerned about build your own regulation? We've talked about this. At some level, the firms would prefer box-ticking regulation as opposed to regulations where they have to devise and design their own systems. Will a regulator turn around and say that's not good enough? I mentioned as well last week, there's kind of an ethical project here as far as the regulators are concerned. They want to make firms think. What is acting in the best interest of your client? Are you doing that at the minute? How would you do it better? You know, design a system that acts in the best interest of your client. There's something ethical there about making all these investment firms think about their clients in that fashion. Okay. So the FSA's Conduct of Business Sourcebook, COBS, which you can get off fsa.gov.uk. All of that's there. Suitability. I think this is our key idea. Ultimately, it's all about suitability. You've got to provide suitable products for your client in a suitable way. So, to rehash under 3.2, we've got to treat our clients honestly, fairly and professionally in accordance with their best interests. And over the page, an idea that I find really interesting. I know, warning sirens going off in your heads. Here we go. Does this create, in our substantive law, fiduciary obligations? Is the obligation to act to the client's best interests? Is the obligation to achieve the best possible results, the best execution requirement? Are these fiduciary obligations? Well, let's take a second just to think about what it means to be a fiduciary. I've got three definitions of what a fiduciary duty might entail on page 31. Lord Justice Millett in Bristol and West Building Society in Mothew. A fiduciary is someone who is undertaken to act for or on behalf of another in a particular matter in circumstances which give rise to a relationship of trust and confidence. Let's remind ourselves of what the ramifications of that are. Chapter 5 in the book, I talk about fiduciaries and how they relate to finance in particular. Not a very long chapter, but that's where I do that in the book. Remember, if you are found to be a fiduciary, those of us that study Property 2, for example, you're not allowed to take secret profits, yes, unauthorised, undisclosed profits, if you're acting as a fiduciary. You're not allowed to take fees and commissions unless those things are explicitly permitted by the trust instrument or whatever it may be. So if you do take any such profits, any property you acquire with those profits or the profits themselves may be held on constructive trust. To use the jargon, you have to account for those profits to the other person. You have to act with the utmost loyalty to the beneficiary of your fiduciary arrangement. Now, this is something which banks ordinarily don't want. Much later in the course, we're going to talk about a case called Foley and Hill from the mid-19th century in the House of Lords. F-O-L-E-Y, Foley. And that tells us that ordinarily, I've mentioned this case briefly before, ordinarily when a bank takes a deposit from a customer, the bank is not acting as a trustee. Yes, the bank doesn't hold that money on trust. So when you deposit your money with the bank, your bank account record changes. The bank says, in your account, in inverted commas, you now have this amount of money. If you're in credit, that means that you are a creditor of the bank. The bank owes you a debt, but it's simply a debtor-creditor relationship. It's a purely personal relationship. So the general understanding of banking then is that it's not fiduciary. Okay. Unless the bank explicitly is acting as trustee for you. Yeah. So, you know, all the stuff we've done in Property 2, in trusts law, unless the bank, you know, expressly takes on a fiduciary obligation. Ordinarily it's not. So what may be a game-changing idea is this idea that MiFID perhaps is imposing positive obligations now on banks that possibly are fiduciary, having to act in the best interests of the client, having to achieve the best possible result. That would impose a whole dimension of private law obligations on banks that otherwise banks, A, don't want, the traditional banking law would thought they wouldn't bear. And this is game-changing stuff, I reckon, for us as private lawyers. Game-changing stuff. So Lord Justice Millett's definition, it has to be a relationship of trust and confidence. And so that's where we might say, well, the old case of Foley and Hill says this isn't ordinarily a relationship of trust if a, you know, financial institution takes a deposit from you. Okay, but we're not talking about taking deposits. We're talking about investment firms advising you on investment products, acquiring investments for you. So if they're supposed to act in your best interest, achieve the best possible result, does that elevate it to being a relationship of trust and confidence? Are we now saying that clients are able to say, well, according to MiFID, this investment firm is supposed to act in my best interest, they're supposed to achieve best execution for me. So I now have confidence in them that they're going to do that, because it's a positive obligation the FSA imposes on them. I think there's a very good argument that that becomes a fiduciary obligation for the first time. Paradigm shift, as they say. Someone who is undertaken to act for on behalf of another. Well, an investment firm giving investment advice would be undertaking to act for or on behalf of another. So the key bit of Lord Justice Millett's definition there would be whether or not you think there's trust and confidence. Yeah, the bankers would say, no, Foley and Hill, it's not a trust, but you know, we now look at the terms of those obligations. Now, that's a comparatively narrow definition of fiduciary compared, I say comparatively, compared to Lord Brown Wilkinson and White and Jones from 1995. There's a fiduciary duty, according to Lord Brown Wilkinson, where one party has assumed to act in relation to the property or affairs of another. It's astonishingly broad. We've assumed to act in the affairs of another. Assuming we don't mean romantic affairs. You know, if you take a letter from someone and say, I will post it for you, are you acting in their affairs? Do you become a fiduciary in relation to that letter? There's one of our graduates who was trying to get a pupillage somewhere. And it was a chambers I'd been at, and I ran someone from the chamber and said, I'm staggered, why didn't you offer her a pupillage? I'm not aware we got her application. She'd given it to a friend to post, and the friend simply hadn't. Post your own. Take them there yourself. Don't give them to someone else to do for you. That's nothing to do with finance law. So Lord Brown Wilkinson's definition is very broad. I mean, compared to Lord Justice Millett's. Assumed to act in relation to the property or affairs of another. Someone's investing your money for you or giving you investment advice, not necessarily even controlling your money. Is that someone assuming to act in your affairs? Taken literally, why not? the killer for me, I think, is Lord Justice Asquith in Reading and the Attorney General from 1951. A fiduciary relation exists, according to Lord Justice Asquith, whenever the plaintiff entrusts to the defendant a job to be performed. Whenever the plaintiff entrusts to the defendant a job to be performed. Go and rake the leaves. I mean, for instance, the negotiation of a contract on his behalf or for his benefit, and relies on the defendant to procure for the plaintiff the best terms available. That sounds almost exactly like best execution under MiFID. Getting the best terms available, procuring the best possible result. They seem to me to be incredibly close. So I think on that definition of what it constitutes to be a fiduciary, it looks as though the best execution requirement says that for investment firms providing advice and services in relation to investment products, looks to me like they could well be elevated to being fiduciaries. Which, as we know, takes them into a whole other ball game. Okay, you might say, fair enough. We know about fiduciaries. The big way of getting around fiduciary relationships last year was Lord Justice Millett again. Case of Armitage and Nurse, if you remember from Property 2, those of you who have done Property 2. Armitage and Nurse from 1998, Chancery at 241, I think. Armitage, A-R-M-I-T-A-G-E, Armitage and Nurse. Where Lord Justice Millett held, if you recall, you can exclude your liabilities as a trustee, providing you don't do so dishonestly. Yeah. So the great way of getting around your liabilities as a fiduciary, specifically a trustee, would be to, in the trust instrument, exclude your liability. And if you recall, what was really going on there was Lord Justice Millett was on a kind of a mission to make trusts law seem more commercial by putting it in parallel effectively with contract law and saying, well, commercial people can limit their liabilities because they want that reassurance if they're going to use trusts. Just the same way that people were doing contract law. So how does that work with conduct of business? Bottom of page 31, so I know I'm hopping slightly. Very bottom of page 31, no exclusion of liability, COBS, paragraph 2.12R. The R means this is a rule as opposed to simply a guidance note. It's a regulated rule as opposed to simply a guidance note. So paragraph 2.12, a firm must not, in any communication relating to designated investment business, so anything that falls within FISMA, basically, and thus within COBS, must not seek to, one, exclude or restrict, or two, rely on any exclusion or restriction of any duty or liability it may have to a client under the regulatory system. So conduct of business stops you excluding your regulatory obligations. They are non-excludable. So, I would suggest, if the best interest and the best execution requirements do create fiduciary liabilities, they are not excludable. And that was one of the ironies I hummed past a little bit when we did Property 2, was that Lord Justice Millett was trying to shove trust law in a direction he thought was more commercial, was actually some of the most commercial areas are saying you may not exclude your liability, particularly in regulatory fields. So financial regulation is going in the opposite direction from Lord Justice Millett. I wonder if they passed one another on the motorway. Quickly through communications. So how do we communicate? This is heading 3.3 on page 31 still. All information addressed to clients or potential clients shall be fair, clear and not misleading. That seems to me to cover all those things on that bullet pointed list. Promotional literature. So, you know, stuff you send to people who aren't yet your clients. The conduct of business letter, the conduct of business agreement itself. In your seminar, basically I've made up a kind of conduct of business questionnaire a firm might have sent to a hypothetical mythical client. And you're encouraged to have a read of it and consider, given what the firm did with that client, having got that back, did they treat that person appropriately under conduct of business regulation? So effectively you're being asked to consider these general principles and think, what should the firm have done given what that guy said and didn't say? Okay? Are there any other questions you think they should have asked, so on and so forth? So it really is speculative, kind of up in the air type stuff. So that conduct of business letter, that's the kind of thing I mean, when you do this business of asking your client, what do you know? Now, statements at meetings, statements on the telephone, ordinary correspondence, generic circulars, as well as bespoke literature, things you send to that client specifically. I think all of these things must count as communications. Misleading information, I think Hedley Bird can help us, as I said before. We don't know what fair means, and what does clear mean? Who knows? Drop a couple of bullet points for the transparency. Under Article 19.3 of MiFID, we have to be transparent about fees charged and all other commissions. And so the provision 19.3 is set out there. We have to, looking at the dashed things, be clear about the investment firm and its services, all financial instruments and proposed investment strategies. Note, importantly, I would suggest, this should include appropriate guidance on and warnings of the risks associated with investments in those instruments or in respect of particular investment strategies. So you must, keyword appropriate, but you must give guidance and warnings about the risks. Okay. Now you also have to give advice about execution venue, so where's the best place, which jurisdiction, so on and so forth, which market should we acquire this in, and any costs and associated charges. It says at the very end, this information may be provided in a standardised format. And what most financial institutions are going to want to do is to try and come up with a standard process and a standard form of wording for particular types of client, how you will deal with them. But it's still quite a difficult thing. You know, this suggests you can't let a single client get through. None left behind. What I want to focus on, I think, is very important. 3.4 is client classification. Client classification. This is the heart of this idea. We have to identify the level of expertise in our client and then treat them suitably as a result. This is all set out in Article 19.4 of MiFID, and I reproduce some of the language from MiFID under heading 3.4. In effect, there's an obligation to warn the client, not to prevent the transaction. So that's quite important, I would suggest. We don't have to stop them doing something. We just have to give them fair warning. We have to give them a warning that's appropriate to their level of expertise. But then if they choose to go ahead and do something that you've warned them about, that's up to them. So it's kind of a modification of the free market. It's a modification of freedom of contract. Okay. There are different categories of client. Three rough definitions. Retail clients, meaning ordinary members of the public who don't necessarily have any experience at all. Usually referred to colloquially as retail. Yeah, the likes of you and I walking in off the street. Then there are professional clients. They'll be people, whether companies or individuals, often individuals, who have some experience of financial matters. And that divides, as you'll see in COBS itself, between per se professional clients, meaning people who are just in themselves professional clients, and so-called elective professional clients, people who ask to be treated as professionals. I know all about this stuff, don't debate me. Yeah. You are allowed to trade up in COBS. You are allowed to say, I demand to be treated in the following way. Which I think is something of a contradiction in terms. I'll come back to that later. And so-called eligible counterparties. I prefer the expression market counterparties. Other financial institutions who should know better. I want to come back to Bankers Trust and Damala, but I just want to take you through 19.4 and 19.5. MiFID 19.4, classifying client knowledge. All this is discussed in gratuitous detail in chapter 10 in the book. Okay, so I'm just going to lead you through the provision. When providing investment advice or portfolio management, the investment firm shall obtain the necessary information. I think that's a key expression. You have to obtain the necessary information. What does necessary mean in the context? Again, for you to discuss and talk about. Must obtain the necessary information regarding the client's or the potential client's knowledge and experience. So it's the necessary information about their knowledge and experience in the investment field, relevant to the specific type of product or service, his financial situation and his investment objectives, notice these are all men, so as to enable the firm to recommend to the client or potential client the investment services and financial instruments which are suitable for him. So that word suitable again. So what you're doing in a problem is you're looking at the scenario and thinking, we've got to obtain all necessary information about what? client's knowledge and experience in the investment field, and then we've got to recommend investments which are suitable. Okay. So it's necessary, knowledge and experience about investment, and suitable. Okay. Those are the key things you're looking for. In that sense, not rocket science. I really am encouraging you in assessment terms to telescope down on that bit. Okay, that's what we're looking for. Those are the key expressions. And you're looking at the facts thinking, what do you reckon?
Yes.
Yeah, from all that's in your brain, what do you reckon on the facts in front of you? Have you got all the necessary information? What more would you like to have known? Okay. We don't have case law on this. You know, we are going to have to try and figure this out as lawyers and make finance law. I promise we would. Could be all right. Everyone's got really tense. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. 19.5, warnings.
Yes.
What the firm must do if the product is unsuitable. So if you think someone's saying, I want an interest rate swap. Yeah. You think, no, you don't understand what they are. What must the firm do? Member states shall ensure. So remember, this is a directive telling member states what their regulations have got to say. Member states shall ensure that investment firms, when providing investment services, other than those referred to, must ask the client or potential client to provide information regarding his knowledge and experience in the investment field, relevant to the specific type of product or service, offered or demanded, so as to enable the investment firm to assess whether the investment service is appropriate for the client. Repeating the same kind of stuff, basically, but notice the word appropriate has replaced suitable, by the way, interesting. In cases the investment firm considers, on the basis of the information referred to under the first subparagraph, that the product or service is not appropriate to the client or potential client, the investment firm shall warn the client or potential client. This warning may be provided in a standardised format. So, if you spot something that the client wants to do that isn't appropriate for that client, you have to warn them. Now, it says a warning. It doesn't tell us in detail what that warning must contain. But it can be in a standardised format, so it can be a generic warning you give to that kind of client in that kind of circumstance. So we can design a system to do it and do it automatically. But what a warning means, what's enough to constitute a warning, is difficult. That's a difficult one for the banks. To what extent do we have to warn? Do we have to rush up to them in the street, grab them by the lapels and say, don't do it! Don't jump! You know, what does it involve? Or can it just be one of those generic, you know, you must be assuming liability, rah, rah, rah. Which I think goes back to a low start of integrity, acting in the client's best interests and all those kind of things again. Achieving the best possible result. You know, we have to kind of read all those things together, I would suggest. If this is a pyramid, we're now another layer up or down the pyramid, you know, in terms of detail. But I think we have to go back to the idea of integrity at the beginning and thinking, well, if you're providing a generic warning to all your customers, nothing specific to them, is that acting with integrity in its context? In cases where the client or potential client elects not to provide the information referred to under the first subparagraph, or where he provides insufficient information regarding his knowledge and experience, the investment firm shall warn the client or potential client that such a decision will not allow the firm to determine the service or product envisaged as appropriate for him. This warning may be provided in a standardised format. So if you as a customer say, I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you who I am or what my background is or anything about me. Yes, I'm a man of mystery. They will say, dear Mr. Powers, if you are indeed a man of mystery, you know, you're taking this on yourself. You've got to be careful. You know, we are not able to assess the extent of your abilities. Notice it doesn't say you mustn't do the deal. And so what I don't know in sort of contract law terms or in terms of going back to the best interest of the client, and if you have a suspicion that this is an ordinary member of the public who is just rashly and foolishly saying, I don't want any advice, I want to buy it anyway, should you as a firm hold back and say, well, we must have realised this person didn't have the expertise? Or can you say, well, tough luck. We told him twice, we wrote him our standard letter, and he decided to go ahead with it anyway. So I think there's a little lacuna there about what is it you must do as a firm. Bankers Trust and Damala. Go back to that case. Bankers Trust and Damala is there on page 33 at the end of that stuff. Jolly good. Very quickly, this is a case we're going to go round a few times. Morgan Stanley and Puglisi we're going to talk about. We'll talk about this very briefly again when we come back next week. And JP Morgan and Springwell are all cases we're going to go around a few times. We're going to talk about them in detail when we do contract law. But I think Bankers Trust and Damala is an interesting illustration of maybe how private law could deal with all this. Okay? Decision of Mr. Justice Mance. It involved, I've done a podcast on this, it involved Bankers Trust, who are legendary
for their maths and their tech savvy. Yeah? They always did the complex stuff, the mathematically difficult stuff. Yeah? It's kind of their stock in trade. Very good at computer systems and all this complex maths. They were approached by Damala, who are an Indonesian financial institution. So they are a financial institution, they are an investment firm out in Indonesia, but they don't deal in derivatives. And latterly, they claim they didn't really understand how they work. They were sold to what were known colloquially as litigation was rumbling on as high octane swaps. Swaps that were incredibly sensitive to movements in interest rates. Bankers Trust sent them the pricing models, basically the maths that underpinned the product. This is how we're doing it, yeah? Loads of Greek, loads of numbers. When we do this case in more detail, we look at contract law. There's lots of concerns about whether or not there have been fraud, negligent misrepresentation, undue influence and things. There's lots of internal tapes that Bankers Trust suggesting. But some of the Bankers Trust employees are saying, we're going to make a fortune out of these suckers. They don't know anything. Yeah? We'll be able to take these lot to the wall. Now, put that up against best interest now and best execution. We start thinking, actually, would Bankers Trust have passed any of the COBS tests nowadays? Mr. Justice Mance held that there was insufficient evidence to prove fraud and all those kind of things, undue influence, which we're going to talk about in later sessions. What's important for us now is Mr. Justice Mance, looking at the regulation in force at the time, the so-called Bank of England London Code is what it was known, the so-called Grey Book. And he looked at the principles in there which were roughly akin to conduct of business regulation. And he said, I should look at this rule book to tell me how Bankers Trust should treat this kind of client. And he said, looking at what those regulations require, because this is a financial institution, albeit one that isn't expert in this field, because they're a financial institution, there is no obligation on Bankers Trust to explain all of the risks. And therefore, there should be no implied undertaking for Bankers Trust that Damala would suffer no losses. Because what happened was that Fed funds rates in the US moved sharply twice, and Damala made huge losses. They then took out a second interest rate swap, can you believe it, which they thought would reverse the effects of the first one. And they also thought they were going to get it for free. If they made one for Bankers Trust, that's unlikely. And Fed funds rates moved again, and they lost even more money. So interestingly, what Mr. Justice Mance did was to look at the regulation and say, it's that regulation which tells us how we're supposed to deal with contract law. So I think Bankers Trust and Damala is interesting because there's that synergy for the first time between regulation on the one hand, substantive law on the other. Okay, I'm clearly holding other people up. So that'll do for this week. And we'll move on next time to talk about market abuse and criminal law. Jonica, welcome new friend. Hello. Have good weekends and play nicely.